Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money from the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Thank you.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And he messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know. He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a chap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
What's it like to live where you work? For most of us, that's unthinkable. But imagine living and working at one of the biggest factories in the world. A workplace the size of Monaco. For these 17,000 employees, it's reality. They come from all over China, seeking a brighter future at this factory called Yupa. Workers craft coffee makers, irons, and electric grills in staggering quantities every single day. But Yupa is more than a steady paycheck. It's home. People get married here. They send their kids to school here. But the work never stops. Yupa's managers are on a mission to produce new products for every corner of the globe that could forever change the way we think of made in China. Step behind the closed doors of modern China into a factory the size of a city. Welcome to the place that calls itself Factory of the World. By the time you finish watching this program, Yupa's 17,000 Chinese workers will produce nearly 20,000 electrical appliances. Every day they churn out 60,000 irons. Every month, Yupa makes 36,000 coffee makers. That's two new machines for every Starbucks on the planet. And every year, these laborers produce a staggering 18 million electric grills. Stacked side by side, they'd span the Atlantic from New York to London. Chances are you own something built right here. Factories like these don't exist in North America or Europe, but they're not uncommon in China, where labor is cheap. Yupa runs on human sweat alone. No need for robots. To ensure non-stop production, workers need a steady stream of parts. Someone has to make sure those parts get to the right place in time. This is Ming Long Pa. He started work at Yupa in 1994.
I'm in charge of production control. Production control is the brain of the factory. Its main function is to coordinate each department.
If any of Yupa's factories run out of parts, Mr. He's job is on the line.
The production line cannot wait. We have to guarantee that our production is smooth. Running out of materials would affect our efficiency, affect our productivity, and affect our revenue. So I have to fix this in the shortest time possible.
Today, a problem at the iron factory needs smoothing out. Workers on the iron line are low on a crucial part. To keep up production, they need 2,000 units, and they need them now.
Just now I found out the main problems here at the iron department. One major problem is the case for model 603. They need 2,000 right now.
Traditional plants use outside suppliers for their components, not Yupa. To slash costs and stay competitive, Yupa builds its own parts on site. So Mr. He's supplier is only a bike ride away. But even the supplier is dangerously low on stock. Mr. He has found barely enough parts to last the day. When he gets another urgent call. Now the grill factory is low on a crucial component. Grills are the company's most profitable products. Yupa started producing one line of grills in 1994. Now, 60 assembly lines churn out 800 different models. Workers make one grill every 12 seconds. That's 50,000 grills per day, or 1.5 million per month. Enough grills for every person in Dallas. Grills bring in $350 million a year, but Yupa wants more. Little wonder Lu Jinye acts like a general leading his troops to war. By next year, managers expect workers to crank out $500 million worth of grills. Yupa's profits have to rise to outmuscle the competition. Mr. Ye supervises 850 workers on 30 lines.
We have to coordinate all these workers and pull all their thoughts into one. It takes teamwork to accomplish our goals, to get the results we want.
Mr. Ye is obsessed with quality control. His aim? Boost output without compromising quality. In a factory this big, with a production run so massive, even the hyper-efficient Mr. Ye hits a roadblock.
This holder piece holds the grill plate. What we're seeing now is the assembly of this piece. The problem is the size. It's the wrong size.
They've run out of part number 2627. It attaches the core heating element to the frame. Without this simple component, assembly lines will shut down. Unless Mr. Ha finds a fresh supply. And soon.
If we don't get them the parts, 6 production lines will have to stop.
When every part is on hand, grills assemble like a simple puzzle. Wires are linked to the heating element, and the element is fixed to the plate.
When it's not locked down properly, it will fall off. If it falls off, it will burn the hands of our customers and consumers. This job is very important.
Then it's time to connect the power cord.
The brown wire is live and the green wire is neutral. The one with the writing on it matches the brown wire. Connect them and that makes the wire live.
Each grill is inspected for flaws in construction or appearance. Finally, every grill is tested to make sure everything is in working order. On a typical day, Mr. Ye's team must make 700 of Yupa's 50,000 grills. Missing parts cause delays, cost Yupa a fortune, and force workers into overtime to meet their quota. Finding the missing parts falls to Mr. Ha, and the pressure is on. Mr. He finally arrives, and he has good news. He's found 2,000 parts to keep the lines moving, and 50,000 more are on the way. Mr. He's day has ended on a high note. He heads home to a company-subsidized apartment only minutes away. His wife, Hong Zhang-Yu, also works for the plant. Together, they lead a life of relative luxury. Family life in China is a communal affair. His parents and his in-laws live here, thanks to Yupa. It's one more reason workers are fiercely loyal to their company.
Our products all have the Made in China tag. I hope our products can bring to consumers a sense of joy, a sense of it's worth it. This is my biggest wish.
Fulfilling that wish will come at a cost.
When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Yupa's next generation of workers must leave their families behind and devote their lives to the company. It's a place tourists never see. The new face of modern China. Competitive, hungry for profits, and ready to take on the world. Located near the city of Xiaomeng, the Yupa complex sprawls for 1.8 square kilometers, almost the size of Monaco.
We have about over 20 buildings here. You know, the largest building, you know, equal like 4 football fields. You can have 60 to 70 assembly lines. Each assembly line can have 25 to 35 workers in the line.
25 years ago, there were no factories here, only farms. In the 1980s, the Chinese government decided capitalism wasn't so bad after all. The communist regime established so-called special economic zones, designated places for free markets and foreign investments. Yupa, a Taiwanese company, moved here in 1988. In a few short years, it became the largest manufacturer of irons, electric grills, and espresso makers in the world. Yupa is a city unto itself, with restaurants and convenience stores, soccer fields and basketball courts, and living quarters for everyone from students to families. Success made it big, and size keeps it successful. Mass production runs push down costs. Almost all parts are made on-site, keeping supply costs low and parts within easy reach.
Because we are in this location pretty much isolated, we don't have satellite suppliers around us to build, you know, parts for us. So we had to do it in-house, and we had to do it in a large scale.
Yupa's main advantage is a cheap and endless labor force, ready to work for a fraction of a Western wage. 16-year-old Mao Fen Guo left her family and came here in 2008. But Guo isn't just looking for work. She's here to escape poverty and make her mother proud. In China, many parents prefer sons to daughters.
My mother has only two daughters. She's always upset about that. And in order to not let her down, I must work harder and harder.
Guo is a worker in training. With about 1,000 other students, she attends Yupa's on-site trade school. To get here, she had to pass entry exams and pay Yupa tuition. Now she's enrolled in 3 years of study and hands-on training at the factory. If she does well, Guo hopes for a job at Yupa.
At the very beginning, I thought it was very hard. But now that I've gone through all this, it's easier. There's a lot to learn, but I'm still full of confidence.
Today, she and her classmates are learning everything they ever wanted to know and more about irons. To get a job, Guo must learn the ins and outs of every product line.
We're changing constantly. Last time, we were making grills. Then we changed to coffee makers, and now electric irons.
Workers on 27 production lines pump out an iron every 15 seconds, and as many as 60,000 irons a day. Production includes at least 10 separate brands for dozens of companies. With over 30 steps to assembly, iron making is intricate work, and there's no room for error. Assembly starts with a water spray unit, made up of springs, rubber, and washers. With training and practice, it snaps into the spout in seconds.
If it's not closed tight, it will leak or blow. Then it won't work properly.
Now the sprayer and spout are joined to the handle. The two parts of the water reservoir are placed in a heating machine. That melts the space between them and makes the reservoir watertight.
Welding is an important part of production. However, it will be easy as long as we follow our operational guidelines.
Next, the thermostat is attached to the base.
You need to make sure you're using the correct format before you insert the base. Using a wrong base can lead to fire. Wiring is also important. Where there is a wiring mistake, there's hidden trouble.
A plastic buffer is placed between the heating element and the handle to keep the handle and the user's hand from getting too hot. After that, the plug is welded to the back of the iron.
We're connecting the wire for the power supply.
I can do about 4 to 5 pieces every minute and 300 pieces an hour.
Once the spray and steam buttons are attached, it's testing time. First, the steam and squirting functions. Second, the iron's electrical system. Faulty units are either repaired or removed. Finally, irons that pass inspection are packed up and shipped away. The team won't cut corners or settle for second best. Today, Guo and her classmates will put classroom theory into practice and work the iron mine. For a teenager from a small town, living and working in a giant factory can be overwhelming.
My life is not as hard as it was before. I'm getting used to this place now.
Work on the iron line goes better than expected. For Guo, juggling work and school isn't that difficult. The hard part is leaving family and living far from home.
I guess it's learning how to be independent. When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Like China, Guo is adapting to a new world of high technology and tough international competition. And like China itself, she's determined to succeed.
I don't see myself working on the production line forever, doing the same job. Maybe I'm a bit arrogant or too confident about myself, but I want a better future.
For some people, a better future keeps them married to their job. Workers at Yupa are married to the company. Based in southeast China, Yupa is one of the biggest factories on the planet. Today and every day, its 17,000 workers are getting the world ready for breakfast. In the next 24 hours, it will produce 1,200 conventional coffee makers. Over the next 30 days, these assembly lines will deliver 210,000 cappuccino espresso machines. In the space of 1 year, nearly 2.5 million coffee makers will pour out of Yupa and into the kitchens of the world. At the center of all this is Young Lee.
We already have 200 or 300 styles, and we develop and add over 40 new styles every year.
Lee's mandate is crucial and broad. Tackle any problem that could slow down non-stop production.
We have to make every effort to find these problems and to solve them. We have to make sure that every process is working perfectly. Manufacturing shouldn't be delayed because of these problems.
Today, he's got a brand new kind of problem. One of Yupa's big clients has designed a new coffee maker. It's up to Lee to build a working prototype to entice the client into going ahead with mass production. Hundreds of Yupa jobs and millions of dollars in potential business are now in Lee's hands.
Making prototypes is a large portion of my job and is vitally important to the development of the company.
Lee starts by assembling the heating system for the water and steam. Then he carefully places it into the main body. Just when Lee's ready to assemble it all, there are parts missing. The supplier is just a walk away, a long walk, but Lee doesn't mind the distance. Someone special is waiting for him at the supply depot. The person helping him today is his girlfriend. These perks make Yupa more than a place of work. With a workforce of 17,000, many of them married with kids, this factory city turns office space into personal space.
然后工作上面我们是有一点的话就有关系嘛。
Sometimes we work together. For example, if we need the help from the technician to solve production problems, then we meet each other afterwards.
Li Yang Li works in the parts supply department. She first came to Yuba in 2004.
We fell in love at first sight. I always think it must be God who makes her work here and wait for me. Even now, I still think the same.
Yuba management encourages these intimate connections. They believe couples that work together are more loyal to the company.
那我们现在同在一个公司工作的话，当然我们 By working in the same company, we can go to work together and take care of each other. We can see each other more often. What's more, we can be with each other when we have a problem.
在工作上面有什么需要的话，我们可以互相帮忙。
With the missing parts in hand, Li is ready for wiring. Making it all fit into the chamber isn't easy.
我要在有限的空间内，然后将配线
I will have to organize all the electrical wires properly to make sure the coffee maker operates safely.
But the real test will come after shipping. If the client approves of Li's model, Yupa could get a massive order. If it doesn't, hundreds of jobs are on the line.
If I make the prototype in a sloppy way, our customers will lose confidence in the quality of our products. It will be a great loss to our company.
Weeks later, Li's model is approved for mass production. And right away, he sets out to create a brand new production line. It takes a week to prepare the assembly line and train the workers to make the new coffee machine.
Making a coffee maker is not an easy job at all. It requires professional knowledge and a profound understanding of coffee culture.
When the prep is done, Factory City springs into action and works with astonishing speed. Li's prototype took half a day to make. Now line workers churn out 700 machines a day. Li's shift is done, and when work ends at Factory City, romance begins.
然后，平常上下班的时候,
when we're done work, we normally go shopping together or take a walk. It gives us a sense of happiness.
The couple plan to get married at a mass wedding, paid for and organized by the company. All at once, dozens of Yupa workers will tie the knot, while thousands of co-workers look on.
If we take part in the group wedding, with the best wishes of all of our co-workers here, we know we will be getting married in the factory of the world, one dream, and that would be unforgettable.
A mass wedding is the couple's way of showing their love for each other and their passion for Yupa. Chef Xing Ming Li has a passion of his own, feeding the 17,000 workers that power the factory of the world. At Factory City, the day has barely begun. But Chef Xing Ming Li already faces his first daily deadline. Li runs one of five independent restaurants at Yuba. Competition between them is intense. Profits are razor thin. And Li needs thousands of customers every day just to survive. In his eyes, he's not just serving meals, he's fueling the workers that power the factory of the world.
If they don't eat well, or eat enough, they won't have enough energy. Then they won't perform well at Yupa.
It all starts with fresh ingredients. Beef, pork, bok choy, onions, carrots, and winter melon.
We have all fresh seasonal vegetables here. Whatever you can find from the food market, you can find here.
Everything is washed, sliced, and diced. Yupa churns out millions of kitchen appliances a year. But there are no food processors in Lee's kitchen. Nothing is automated. Everything is done by hand. By 9 a.m., Lee's staff is already racing against the clock.
We'll have to finish everything before 11 o'clock because Yupa staff restaurants all open at 11:30. We have to be there in advance.
In 2 hours, 3,000 workers will stop by for lunch. Lee expects just as many for dinner. This means his staff of 50 must serve 6,000 meals by sunset. That's 125 kilograms of oil, 50 kilograms of beef, and 300 kilograms of pork. That's more than 1 million tons of food every year. His chefs turn stock ingredients into hundreds of delicious dishes.
We can make different cuisines. Our chefs are all the best of their hometown.
They cook up dishes from Fujian, Sichuan, and Henan regions, and they'll soon add halal fare for Muslim clients.
I believe everything that we cook should taste like what your mom cooks for you at home.
Lee's obsession with food comes from growing up hungry.
My family was very poor. Although my dad was working very hard to earn money, he still didn't have much food to eat.
Now food is never in short supply, and all of Lee's clients return to work with their bellies full. Lee's passion for food has made him a perfectionist. He hunts the market for produce that's perfectly ripe and reasonably priced. In his kitchens, Lee controls the cooks, and no dish goes out without his approval.
Too bland. Some salt and chicken stock will make it taste better.
The special today is spicy Sichuan pork.
Actually, anyone can cook. The key is our chefs make their own special seasoning that you can't get from the market.
Lee insists the pork must be extremely fresh. He expects perfect timing from every cook.
Timing is what the chefs are really good at, but they may not be willing to share that information.
But now it's almost 10 a.m., and Lee's kitchen is about to hit the boiling point. With the clock ticking, the team of chefs are stir-frying and stewing to feed an army.
It might be a bit of an exaggeration to say that it's a battlefield, but it's true that we're really busy. We have to finish everything within 1 hour. Then we will deliver them to our restaurants. We don't have time to do other things.
By 11 a.m., they pull it off. Dozens of different dishes for 3,000 people and right on time. Drivers rush the dishes to the restaurant nearby. Competition between the five independent restaurants at Yupa keeps quality and choice high and prices low. Workers pay about 50 cents per meal, thanks to a company subsidy. To turn a profit, thousands of customers must pass through Lee's door each day. But it's not profits that keep Lee up at night. More than anything, he wants people to enjoy his food.
I've experienced a lot of sleepless nights. I often blame myself for the mistakes that occurred in the daytime. I should have done better.
So far, his customers look happy. After lunch, while workers crank out appliances, Lee will be planning dinner, determined to satisfy his next 3,000 customers.
I hope that Yupa and everyone else will trust me and become my friends. I'll be content if they all come to dine in my restaurant.
If feeding workers at the factory of the world is tough, try being the guy who must make everyone get along. In this factory city, 17,000 people live and work inside 1.8 square kilometers. Rush hour is a human traffic jam. Just getting to work on time is a job well done. Inside these walls, office politics and conflicts play out on a massive scale. The man managing all this human friction could have Yupa's toughest job of all. Now in his second year on the job, Ya Xin Fu is the manager of Yupa's service department. His job, address anything that affects the day-to-day life of Yupa's 17,000 workers.
I have to find a balance between the costs of the company and the needs of the employees. Too little and the employees will be dissatisfied. Too much and the company won't be happy, so it's a big challenge.
Keeping Yupa's army of laborers in line is no small task. At this regular weekly meeting, Fu is boosting company morale.
Leading them is like raising children. We have to raise them with love.
Yupa's workers come from every corner of China. Most are in their 20s and 30s. They work on average 40 hours a week and make between 90 and 320 US dollars a month. While wages are even higher in big cities like Shanghai, many Yupa workers make double what they did back home if they had any work there at all. As with any mass organization, thousands of employees create endless demands. It's Mr. Fu's job to address all of them. He does everything he can to keep everyone motivated and committed to staying at the factory of the world. Fu visits staff living quarters as part of his regular rounds.
We're now going to the workers' dormitory. I routinely go there to check if anything can be improved. If there is, I will talk to the superintendent.
Fu is part landlord and part tenants' rights advocate. Today, he's ensuring Yupa rooms are ready for a group of new workers. Average rent is only $6 per month, but the type of accommodation depends on a worker's rank and the amount of money they are willing to part with. Fu is paying a visit to Mao Fen Guo, who has a noise complaint. Fu believes that to build quality products, Yupa's workers must be well rested and well fed.
The challenge is that there are 17,000 employees and they come from all over China. Everyone has different tastes. I have to take care of everybody.
Yupa's restaurants are extremely competitive, and some have been known to skimp on meat portions to keep costs low.
This is
UPA has strict rules about when and where vendors can sell their food. Foo keeps them in line.
Now we are going to check on the other restaurants. We have designated areas for them. If they break the rules, I will kick them out.
These vendors aren't trespassing. They work for the factory's restaurants. But they are breaking the rules by selling food too close to rival restaurants. Everyone must have a permit. A veteran on these streets, Phil recognizes this woman. He busted her once before. Today, Fu lets everyone off with a warning. Next time, he may ban them from selling food at UPA.
I talk to them, but they will break the rules again, so I have to check on them every day.
China's web of cultures complicates Fu's job.
Everyone comes from different families and different provinces, so their customs of eating and living are totally different, so I have to adapt to them.
But one thing unites all of UPA's workers, the world's most popular sport. On the field, tension and stress vanish.
Because employees are undergoing a lot of pressure at work, we have to give them an outlet and let them exercise. But most important is the team building.
Don't care for soccer? UPA offers other ways for workers to get their exercise.
For entertainment, we have ball game competitions like basketball, table tennis, and other games. These sorts of competitions.
It's all part of Fu's mission at one of the world's biggest factories, a place with no boundaries between work and life. For Fu, it's a never-ending battle to keep the peace and to keep the company together.
It really is a miracle, a company this big, with all the employees together, holding hands and moving forward. This is not easy.
And while there may be harmony inside UPA's walls, outside, competition is cutthroat. In a global market, innovation is key. UPA's employees must endure tough changes to survive. In the global marketplace, there's no room for second best. To survive, companies need a competitive edge. Like most China-based companies, UPA has relied on low labor costs, making products designed by others. But it wants to move up the production food chain. UPA's leaders want to design products of their own. They have little choice.
All right. Okay, I was on in another conversation on another platform. Talking about incarceration rates. Anyway, all right, today's It's My House live stream here on a holiday weekend, well, tail end of the weekend because it's Monday, is Zoom Towns, Zoom Villages, and the Zoom Economy. And when I speak about Zoom, if you're on our It's My House blog talk platform, scrolling marquee, you see the logo I'm talking about for the pandemic. Everybody's heard about Zoom globally. Everybody, and more than likely, I would say, well, maybe not the whole planet, but a good percentage of the planet in developing countries as well as developed countries have been on a Zoom call in one way or another. All right, so what that has, and we're going to look at the effects of that, the positive effects of it, and what the pandemic has created or helped create are Zoom Towns, and we're going to go what a Zoom Town is, Zoom Villages, And that's one word. I spell it different, you know, same way you spell it, but I just combined the two words. Zoom villages and the Zoom economy. Now, I rarely set foot in this, physically in a church. I can't remember the last time I physically have been in the church. I've walked past plenty, you know, going to the store or something like that around here. But it's been a long time since I've set foot inside of a church. However, since the pandemic, I was attending church sometimes 3-4 times a week. Online, you know, on my laptop, on my or either on my phone. I sent in tithes and offerings. Okay. And the thing about Zoom, it offers the comfort and convenience of, you know, getting ready, getting dressed, you know, you got enough gas in the car, you know, do you have to deal with traffic, you know, all that. So it was easy for me to go to church. I was going to church on Saturday. I was going to church on Sunday. I was going to the Bible study on Monday or Tuesday, and or Wednesday or Thursday. Like I said, I was at one time I was going up to 4 times a week via Zoom. All right. Now, let me give some stats out here. I'm reading in my program notes here on Blog Talk Radio. 16 million people within the United States, and the United States is just one country, 16 million people within the United States have left larger cities to go to smaller cities and or towns because of the affordability, you know, and they are working by Zoom. 29 million Americans, okay, now work remotely from home. Many of those people work a full-time job Monday through Friday, or from the beach, or from Starbucks, or from any place they choose to do so. They can go out of town. They can go not out of town. They can go out of the country. They can go to Canada, Mexico, Europe, Asia, Africa, Antarctica. Is anywhere they can, if they can get an internet connection, they've got a job. Okay, just in the United States alone, 29 million people. I was reading, there was one video I watched this morning, people that were working in Silicon Valley, they left Silicon Valley, started working remotely, and they cut their cost of housing by 70%. So imagine if you're living in $1 million or a house that's valued at $900,000 to $1 million, and they cut it by 70%. Cut it by $700,000. Now, I'm sport. I don't even want to live in a $300,000 house, but that's me. I'm more, you know, give me the materials. Give me the materials list. Give me the plans. I go to Home Depot, Lowe's, Menards, Ace, Lumber 84. I got to go where I got to go. With $3,000 to $5,000, and I'll build my own with some friends' help. Give me 9 friends, I'm good. All right. But anyway, so you've got 16 million people, and it's counting. That more and more people are doing it. So I'm so glad I bought my 4 acres, 7 years ago? I'm so glad I did it. I'm so glad I did it. So they're moving to small towns, and then some people are starting from scratch. This is what I call Zoom villages. Zoom villages. I'm familiar with a group of people. I don't know if all of them are out of Philadelphia. They might be in some other places as well, Ohio, what have you. But they bought 110 acres. Hopefully I can get them on this podcast. They bought 110 acres of land in Georgia, somewhere in Georgia. I'm not going to tell you the town. But 110 acres, I'll let them explain, tell the town if they want to do that. But it's in Georgia, and they bought 110 acres, and just 12 of them. Just 12 of them. But, you know, if they can get, if you can get an internet connection and on that 110 acres, that will be an example of the new communities that are popping up. Well, you know what? They're off the radar. But if you're in certain circles, they're on that radar. And those are the Zoom villages that will be popping up. Just like on our little 4 acres, we'll section off maybe a quarter of an acre, which is plenty of room, and that'll be a Zoom area on that particular 4 acres. But there's, once again, Butte, Montana is a Zoom town. It's part of the, and it's going on right now, it's been happening for the last two years or so, a Zoom, what they call a Zoom boom. So go on any search engine, and, or go on YouTube and type in the terms Zoom Boom, Zoom Boom, B-O-O-M, or Zoom Town. Now, you'll get the most videos and the better videos, in my opinion, that where you can see a visual on Zoom, Z-O-O-M, Zoom Towns. And, of course, that's all part of the Zoom economy. You have little local towns. Like, you know what, one town that's experiencing sort of a Zoom boom, at least a micro Zoom boom, is Newport, Tennessee. Newport, Tennessee. You know, a guy started off there, let me see if I can get him on this podcast. He started building tiny homes there. Then he built a tiny house community, which sold out quickly, and I think he just sold out another development as well. And he started with no money. With two borrowed tools, a skill saw and a sawzall. I think that's how he started. Less than 10 years ago. But I would call Newport, Tennessee, partially at least, a Zoom town. Because there's one particular guy I know, you know, Monday through Friday he puts out a video of what's going on with this, you know, this tiny house manufacturing thing. But the whole Zoom boom thing is not centered around tiny houses or nothing like that. Once again, it's people that are looking for inexpensive places to live. So you got people that have, you know, they're going to Butte, Montana. They're going to town, and once again, I've laid out this statistic several times. There are 19,500 towns, municipalities in the United States. There are more towns than that, but there are 19,500 towns in the United States. Only 10 of them have a population of a million or more people. You know, and two states dominate that. California, all right, let's go with Texas. Texas has three of those, Dallas, Houston, and San Antonio. All three of those cities have a population of at least a million or more people. All right. Then California, you have Los Angeles, San Francisco, and what's the third? I want to get it right here. 10 largest U.S. cities. I want to make sure I get it right. All right. Los Angeles. California has Los Angeles. San Diego. Oh, all right. I thought they had three. Okay, all right, California has two. California has San Diego, and they have Los Angeles. All right, those are the two biggest out of the top ten. They got, yeah, all right, San Diego and Los Angeles. All right, Texas, they have San Antonio. They have Houston. Oh, wait a minute. I thought they had Dallas in there, too. All right. Well, here's the top 10. New York, L.A., California, Chicago's number 3, Houston's number 4, Phoenix is number 5, Philadelphia's number 6, San Antonio, 9, and San Diego, 10. Oh, let me look at somebody else here. Okay. All right, let's see. All right, California has Los Angeles. Oh, man, come on. Don't do this to me. All right, here it is. All right, Los Angeles. All right, California has Los Angeles. Here we go. California does have 3. California has San Jose with over 1 million people. Los Angeles and San Diego. Okay. Los Angeles is ranked number 2 nationwide. San Diego is ranked number 8 nationwide. And San Jose is ranked number 3 nationwide. San Diego comes in at 10. And then Texas has Dallas, San Antonio, and Houston. Houston's the fourth largest city in the United States. And the top 10, New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, Houston, Phoenix, Arizona is number 5, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania is number 6, and then San Diego. So, you have a lot of people moving, well, once again, 16 million people have left larger cities, and some of those cities are not in the, I would say, out of the 19,500 towns, take 10% of that is over 1,900. Let's say out of the 2,000 largest, most populated towns in the country, you got a lot of people that are leaving those areas and going to smaller towns. All right, so I have been preaching that seek out towns that have less than 1,000 people. Not everybody's not going to towns like that, but they're moving to smaller towns. So let's see. All right, Zoom Boom Churches, I talked about that. Zoom Communities, we just talked about that. Greenville, South Carolina, 3,000 people from various areas have moved to Greenville, South Carolina. Greenville, South Carolina has 3,000 Zoom Boomers. All right, so, and some people probably have never even heard of Greenville, South Carolina. So I imagine in the Carolinas, north and south, some in Georgia, they're all over the place. People are going small. Now, of course, if you work at a Walmart or a McDonald's or something like that, you know, you're not going to, more than likely, you have to show up at those jobs. But like I say, some people are opting for that. Let's see what Wikipedia has to say about this. Now, you know, it's in our lexicon now. If Wikipedia's got a write-up on it, a Zoom town, and you can go to Wikipedia and follow up on it if you want to. A Zoom town is a community that experiences a significant population increase due to the influx of remote workers. There's a bachelor's degree or bachelor's degree offered in remote working or in remote employment, but there might be one in the work. But that's where we're at right now. All right, the term came popular during the COVID-19 pandemic, so Zoom towns are also a trending topic. It's trending. It's what's happening. The population of Zoom towns has had a significant economic implications. The name is a play on Boomtown, a community that undergoes a sudden rapid growth, and Zoom and the video conferencing software. Because you have people having video conferencing on YouTube, Facebook, Zoom, StreamYard. You know what? Hold up. Let me see if I can get her. Let me see if I can get her to call in. Where are we? Let's see. Get her take on it. If she's available. Okay, now, definition, I'm still on Wikipedia, under Zoomtown. Definition, in 2020, the COVID-19 pandemic led to the phenomenon of a significant migration to previous getaway communities and small towns near attractions such as resorts in conjunction with the increases of the popularity of remote work. In March of 2020, the pandemic forced many workers to transfer to remote work and attractions such as ski resorts. In a Gallup poll in September showed that nearly 60% of the workers remained working remotely full-time, and two-thirds of employees wanted to stay away, giving more flexibility in where they live. Before the pandemic, and just to give you a visual on that, I saw a map this morning. You have Silicon Valley workers in California that live in Texas or even Maine. Okay. Let's see. Before the pandemic, only 10% or less of the workers in the United States work remotely full time. People working remotely found that they could attain the same normalcy by hiking, biking, skiing, snowshoeing, and other outdoor activities while cities were locked down, and they did not need to commute to work. A November study by the Pew Research Center found that the result of the pandemic, around 5% of Americans had moved in the prior several months to the study. Impact. In the United States, locations such as the Hamptons in New York, Cape Cod, Massachusetts, Aspen, Colorado, Bethel, Maine, and Truckee, California, which usually were considered vacation destinations, have been seeing huge spikes in people moving there. Truckee, for instance, saw a 23% increase. Now, you know, as I'm reading this, black folks, black Americans, now, we're usually last in getting in on trends. We need to jump in on this one. We need to jump in on it. All those black towns I've mentioned over the last 7 years I've been on, no, 8 years I've been on here. Hey, go to Eatonville. Instead of going to Orlando, Florida to live, try out Eatonville, Florida. Okay. Instead of people talk about Rosewood. All right, Rosewood is in Levi County, Levy County, Florida. Come to Levy County, Florida, and buy you some acres of land. Buy yourself 20 to 40 acres of land. Levy. It's available and it's cheap, and nobody's going to bother you. If you're up in Illinois, why don't you go to Hopkins Park or Pembroke, Illinois? If you're in Maryland, go to Anne Arundel County, or go to Western Maryland. That's what I recommend now if you're going to be in Maryland. Go to Western Maryland, buy you some acres of land, and start your own community. Or very least, on a family level, buy you a couple of acres of land, which is the size of 2 football fields, plenty of land. Well, I mean, 1 acre, but plenty of land. And then build a family compound. But don't be sitting on this one for the next 5 to 10 years. We missed the dot-com boom. There's a boom going on right now. It's been going on for the last 2 years. That's why I'm so glad I bought I bought the 4 acres about 6 years ago. Oh, no, 6 or 7 years ago I bought the 4 acres. And I bought the 10 acres in Texas about 5. That's why I play that solar cabin thing all the time. Anyway, impact. So in the United States, many small western mountain towns have seen significant numbers of wealthy migrants, leading some observers to call the wealthy Zoom towns a billionaire's wilderness. I'm going to tell you this, if you're not a billionaire, these little towns, in a lot of places that look like wilderness, you can become one if you're super ambitious. But if you just want to, you know, get out of the hustle and bustle and be able to save a paycheck, even if you're working at McDonald's on a fry machine, these small towns are where it's at. Now, don't take L.A.'s word on it. Go to YouTube, type in Zoom Towns. There you're going to see Mr. Charlie and Mrs. Charlie and all the Charliette children. You're going to see them in these small towns. Take their word for it. They have moved to these locations. I'm just saying these black townships are a gold mine. And you better get there before somebody that's coming in from Ukraine or coming in, you know, or Lebanon or coming in from Haiti or coming in from Mexico, because that's what's happening up in Illinois. Latinos have discovered Pembroke, Illinois, and Hopkins Park. They've discovered it. They haven't taken over, and I hope they don't, but they're there. I was there, four years ago? They're there. They haven't taken over, and hopefully they won't, but they're there. And they're not trying to get a job at the post office or a government job. And they can work remotely, knowing what they had to do. In Europe, some countries such as Italy, Romania, Poland, Latvia, Bulgaria, which had experienced a brain drain in preceding years, found that young professionals returned home as they began working remotely, a trend which was further encouraged by some governments in the form of tax breaks for returning citizens. They're offering certain places, certain towns in the United States right now as I speak, are offering incentives to $10,000 if you move to that town and you stay a year. There are towns right now in the United States that's offering that. So this is examples of Zoom towns and regions in the United States. I'll read this all. And this is all in the Wikipedia article. Aspen, Colorado, Bellevue, Washington, Bethel, Maine, Boise, Idaho, Bozeman, Montana, Burlington, Vermont. I absolutely love Burlington. I've been there twice. When I was on my way a few years ago to a tiny house summer camp, I had to go through, I actually stayed in Burlington. And the second time I was there, I flew in to the Burlington Airport and stayed there. And then I got flu burns, so I had to stay there, you know, extra week to recover. But Burlington is, man, it's, I didn't even know I was part of this until I read this. You know, I ran across a video earlier this morning. Burlington, Vermont, and it's not far from the Canadian border either. Absolutely fabulous. I mean, Vermont, I could live in that state. I can live in that state. Anyway, Cape Cod, Massachusetts, Carlsbad, California, Carmel, Indiana, the Rust Belt is sweet, Indiana, Ohio, Western Pennsylvania, all those places, Cary, North Carolina, and I'm going to come back to North Carolina, Cary. I'm going to see what's near Cary. Centennial, Colorado. Let's see. Greater Danbury, Connecticut. Fremont, California. I think that's not too far from Albert Lea out there. Frisco, Texas. Never heard of Frisco, but Texas is big. Gilbert, Arizona. The Hamptons in New York. Henderson, Nevada. Hudson Valley, New York. Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Lake Tahoe, California. League City, Texas. Missoula, Montana. I got to go there. And then Viata was out in Montana a few years ago. What? Hopefully she'll call. Canada. Some places in Kansas. Roseville, California. Sandy Spring, Georgia. Santa Floria, Italy. Another location in Italy. Thousand Oaks, California. Torrance, California. And Truckee, California. Now, there are more places than that. Okay. That's just included in this article, just to wet your whistle. On Zoom Towns, the pandemic has given birth to that. All right. Mount Bayou, Mississippi would make a good Zoom Town. Let's see what else do I have on my notes. All right, once again, 16 million people in the United States have left larger cities to live in smaller towns. It's all part of the Zoom boom. 29 million Americans now work remotely. Just an isolated snapshot, Greenville, South Carolina has 3,000 new residents. And let's take a closer look at Greenville, South Carolina. Okay, Greenville, now they have a population of 69,000 people. All right. Not big. I wouldn't call it small either by my standards, but, you know, they have 3,000 more residents that are there that are remote workers. And still, a lot of these people just came from larger cities or from different areas. Some probably could have came from New York. Or that, if you take that from Richmond, Virginia, on up to Boston, I mean, that's a very densely populated area. But, you know. Anyway, Greenville is one of the cities that has benefited from it. There are smaller towns, which I would call villages. Let's see. They also, if you're on the verge of homelessness or eviction or foreclosure in some of these larger cities, I would recommend move to these smaller towns where you can live sustainably. That's what I would recommend. Okay, let's see. Now, here's another term I want to put out there. And you can look this up online and look it up on YouTube. Overemployed. Overemployment. Overemployed. I think you might have more luck with overemployment. What is overemployment? And I discovered this term and what it's all about this morning. Matter of fact, let me see if I can find something online to read to you guys. But overemployment is a person who has multiple jobs. And there might be multiple full-time jobs. This is a trend, and it's been a trend, it's been a thing in IT circles for some years now. I didn't know it until like 3 or 4 o'clock this morning. I know it now. Overemployed, and I'm not talking about, because at one time I had two jobs and sometimes three. Okay, two full-time jobs, and then I had a weekend job. No, that's not it. There's one, on one video, and I put it, I think I posted on our Facebook page. If you go to our Facebook page, which is It's My House TV on Facebook, I think I posted it on there. And in the video somewhere, there's a guy with 11 full-time jobs. That's overemployment. Now, how is a guy or woman, how are they able to handle 11 full-time jobs? And they have these 11 jobs in 10 different states. That's why I posted the video up on our Facebook page. It's Wild TV. It's in one of those videos I posted up there within two or three of them. The top, whatever the top one, I think that's it. But they're working remotely. They're working remotely. And in the process of working remotely, 11 full-time jobs in 11 different states. Oh, excuse me, 10 different states. 11 jobs, 10 different states. I don't want Overbrook Entertainment. They're able to take in anywhere from, and there are other people doing this, they're able to take in, I ran across some guy 25 years old making $500,000 a year from home. He's got multiple jobs. He can work online. Another guy's doing, I think the guy with 11 jobs, I think he takes in $1.2 million a year. Once again, it's overemployed. Look up that term. Okay, let me see if they got a Wikipedia article on here. Let me go check my Facebook page. Vetted him, and they verified he had 11 full. Let's see, but they've coined the term overemployment, which means essentially, you know, they have multiple jobs. Let's see. Groups. I want to make sure. And I sent it out to a bunch of people I know. Okay, yeah. If you go to our Facebook page. All right, hold it. Wait a minute. Okay, wait a minute. Okay, here's what we're going to do. Let me see if I got it on my main Facebook page. Because you guys have got, you got to listen to this dude. I got to go find it for you. I got to go find it for you. You know what? I sent it out in a bunch of texts. I need to post it on Facebook. So, all right, I'm trying to get a caller in here to speak. Oh, here we go. Here we go. Viara, could you ready to talk, Viara? I got to ask you a couple of questions. Based on a video you did about a week or two ago, press 1 if you're available. Or can she hear me? Okay, here we go. Okay, yeah, thanks, Viola, for calling in. We've been talking about Zoom towns and Zoom economies. And a Zoom town, just in case you don't know, in the United States, over 16 million people within the last 2 years have left larger cities to go live in smaller communities because the cost of living is less expensive. So, and they're working remotely. 29 million Americans now work remotely throughout the United States. So a lot of these towns where these smaller towns where they have relocated to are called Zoom towns because people can work a full-time job and not have to deal with rush hour going into the office. Like, when you lived in California, did you live near or near the Silicon Valley?
Yes, I was in their backyard. Okay.
Their paycheck says they work for Apple or whoever in Silicon Valley, but they actually physically do the work remotely in Austin, Texas, or Orlando, Florida, or Bangor, Maine. So they call those people, and then some of those people, they might have 10 or 11 full-time jobs like that. So they call those overemployed. But then there's some towns that have developed. I mean, not only developed, but there's some towns, smaller towns, where they've experienced a population boom, and they call it a Zoom boom or a Zoom town because these people have moved to Bozeman, Montana, and you've been to Montana at least once that I know of. The company is in one place, but physically they're doing the work in another place. Those are called Zoom towns. So I asked you to call in because there are other people that are buying land and setting up their own communities. And some of these communities probably are not officially on the radar yet as far as people knowing the name. But you interviewed somebody about a week or two ago. So I was wondering if you can share that information about what your guest shared with you on that particular interview on the Otter Tiny House Village.
About Prince Israel?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So he bought over 100 acres of land in Sparta, Georgia, which is about, I understand, that's about an hour east of Atlanta. So he's not too far from, urban area, but 100 acres of land, ain't nothing on it. So, and he was also involved in the purchase of land not far from the one he purchased that was over 100 acres. So this guy is really building an empire. He purchased the land outside of Atlanta, and now he's building in what he calls an empire and planning. Number one, they got the equipment to dig their own wells. So they have the equipment. I think they're working on a well on the property. And then they plan to build one tiny house at a time. So they're not going to, clear all the land and then, come bring in big machines to build five houses in 1 month or two or whatever. He's got a family, I think, of about 12 people now who are working on that land and planning how it's going to be organized. So he's a polygyny supporter or believer in that he has four wives right now and 16 children the last time we talked or interviewed. So 16 children. Most of his children are grown because he's had two wives he's been married to for over 30 years. And he shared on my health and well-being show, he doesn't have intercourse with the two older wives, but they're very good friends, and it's a partnership, a kingdom-building thing. And the two older wives, of course, are the mothers of the older children. And I imagine the two younger wives, one he's been, I think he said 9 years or something, and the other one 4 months. So they are the ones who are having the younger babies now, or having the baby, and the family continues to grow. Now, he has his own business in Philadelphia, so he can't leave Philadelphia because that's the financial support for all the other things he's doing. I think he's a contractor or a construction company, something like that. So this is, and he says it's not easy, or it's very challenging, number one, to have four wives and then all the children and all that, but he has a purpose, and his purpose is building an empire. And it starts, and his desire has been to have his own land. And so they're slowly building, and the process continues of building the empire. So that's the summary of it all.
Okay, well, there are other people, I suspect, like him, that will, or his group, because I think the group, I'm not talking about the family part, but the group is, I think, 12 people.
Right.
Yeah, that's involved with the, what the development of it.
I'm on the Female Solution Blog Talk Radio Show, and that's what Naima Latif, the producer's book, is about, polygyny, developing communities that support healthy children, healthy relationships. And, you know, I had one woman who was upset that he had four wives. It's like, really? At this stage of our Earth journey and existence, you should be praising, in my opinion, you should be praising a man who can manage such an empire. Because women are, for years, have been aborting babies. The black population has been reduced mostly, or hasn't even come into existence, because women are killing the babies for convenience sake or whatever reasons. And this man, and then this woman had the nerve to criticize him for having four wives. So that's the mentality we have to overcome to develop new paradigms and new communities, new families that are building empires. And whether it's black or white, I don't care about the color. I'm not into race thing or have the color of the skin and all that. That's irrelevant to me. The issue is consciousness about these Zoom communities that people are excited about, something new that can change the old paradigm of sickness and disease and debt and conflict. Debt, and just focus on developing healthy relationships, building a kingdom, empire with people of like mind, no matter what color they are. I'm finished. I yield the floor.
Oh, okay. There are 12 of them. Anyway, I guess the nucleus is in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. But did he give any particular reason why they selected Georgia?
Well, that's where the first land was purchased with some other men, I believe. So I think the whole community, mostly Hebrew Israelite community, are trying to stay together, I guess, and create something in that area, maybe, since they already, and maybe it was a good deal, the land purchase was, the price was right, all that, you never know. I don't know all the details, but I'm sure the first land was purchased there with another group, so they found other land close by that had probably had a good price on it, and the guy said it's debt-free, he doesn't owe anything from this land, so. And then he's going to probably slowly create his empire with no debt. That's the focus. That's the whole goal, no debt. Just do what you got to do and don't get the banks involved. If a government, as little as possible.
Well, they've got a good group. I know two people. Master, I spoke to two of them yesterday. So it's zero debt. And they got, like I said, 110 acres.
That's what the black community has trouble doing, unifying, creating an empire. We have so, because we're all over the place. I say black people are all over the place in their egos, trying to get rich and have a 3-bedroom, 4-bedroom house with a 5-car garage, whatever, and not focusing on unity in the neighborhood or the family. So that's what Hebrew Israelites in his empire are doing, they're creating right. an empire. Like-minded people. Doesn't matter what color they are.
I think that's the key. That's the key.
Yeah.
If you can get, and it doesn't have to be something that he said in an interview that you did with him. He said, because when I asked him how many did he have, he said he had 12. But he said you can do a lot with just three. So I was very impressed when he said that. But I suspect now, and I consider what they're doing part of the Zoom boom. I'm pretty sure there are other people out there like that, but you know they're not getting the fanfare because they're not, you know, they're not in mainstream media or nothing like that, which is a good thing. But I'm pretty impressed with that. Speaking of which, all right, today's Monday, it's a holiday, but what do you have going through this week?
My whole family.
Particularly Friday and Sundays.
Huh?
Particularly Fridays and Sundays.
Well, today I'm gathering at an old neighbor's house with my ex-husband, my son, my grandchildren, and I don't know who else is going to be there. We're all just getting together to create fun and family and swim. There's a swimming pool in the neighborhood, so we're going to relax today and enjoy family. And, you know, each day, L.A., we need to prepare for the fear-mongering that this government is promoting, because that's what the media right now, monkey business, and the government more and more pushing vaccine jabs for people as a solution to something that is affecting mostly gay men. Now, how do you rationalize that? You just look at this government as drama show, Saturday Night Live. That's how I look at our government, Saturday Night Live episode number whatever. Because they have lost their effing minds. They're not serving the people so much as promoting their own agenda for war, make more and debt, more debt. Talk about, you know, building an empire and with land and no debt. This government is like totally opposite. You need to depend on us for your jabs, your drugs, and we want everybody to be in debt, what it takes to send out free checks and all that. This is so insane. It's another, like our Surgeon General, I did a show about last night about our Surgeon General, Ladapo, for Florida. Man is brilliant. And he's promoting health for Florida citizens, not vaccines. And he is what every state needs right now is to come out of the fear, because he had a trauma as a child that he healed in 2019, and that's what gave him an attitude of no more fear. No more fear, just promoting health to our citizens, giving them what they need or want, not pressuring them with mandates. So, and then people, of course, on one side of the political scene, they hate him. They don't want him in there. But we got to look at people like Ladapo as a jewel in this whole scenario of Twilight Zone episodes. Because he's the only one making sense, along with DeSantis, making sense about what we're going through. So prepare. My Friday show, Health and Wellbeing, it's going to be all about preparing for this fear-mongering that's going to heat up in the next month, because they got to get their jab money. And more people are going to be getting sick from all the jabs they've already had. And the booster, just prepare. I'm all about helping people be prepared and preventing the fiasco of the last 3 years.
Well, fiasco for some, a Zoom boom for others.
Right.
Now
right.
You went out to Brazil, not Brazil. You went out to Montana some years ago. What city did you fly into?
Crow Nation. I don't know, Montana. Okay, what did I go? I can't remember where I flew, but Crow Nation, wherever the Crow Nation is, that's where I was headed.
Yeah, did you fly into like Butte, Montana, or Bozeman?
Where is Crow Nation? Let me see. I don't know where they are.
All right, well, let's look them up real quick. Crow Nation. Montana. Okay.
So
all right, Crow Nation, which is a huge...
southern part of Montana.
All right, it's near... part of it is near Billings, Montana.
Yeah, Billings. I think that's where I flew into.
Okay. So, because Montana has... Bozeman, Montana is considered a Zoom town due to, you know, people, you know, moving there for the cheaper cost of living. But when you went to the reservation out there, the res, as they call it, and was it densely populated, or is it a place where you can get peace, quiet, and work remotely with an internet connection?
Oh, yeah, you could. I'm sure they have all that technology. Peggy, well-known Buffalo, who runs the center there in Crow, in that area, she had, I know, yeah, plenty Wi-Fi and all that. But that whole community, it was kind of sad to me, all the standard American diet that they were eating, overweight, diabetes, disease. And then the biggest revelation I had while I was there was the child trafficking that's going on through the social services department there. They're just time in so many ways. They need a lot of help. And Peggy Well-Known Buffalo is the light in that area that she's always being attacked in some way because of the light she brings to that area. So, yeah, they have a battle, real battle. They have a different battle going on the reservation now, alcohol, child trafficking, and then a bunch of leaders who are totally bought and paid for by the government. It's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my experience.
Now, you spent most of your time on a reservation, so you really didn't get to zip around any other small little communities around there, I imagine.
No, the reservation's big enough to explore with. They had a big powwow while I was there because there was a celebration of sorts going on and an anniversary and all this food. Oh, my goodness. Food was disgusting. So, anyway, yeah, I didn't get to. It was enough. My education was focused on that one particular community of tribes, and the disease state and of mind and body was evident, and then the trafficking that was revealed to me in an unusual way, that some woman had put her child as a foster, or had one of the community women had put her child in the foster system, and they got lost. She was coming to Peggy Well-Known asking her for help because she couldn't find her child who had been taken from her, put into foster care. Now they don't know where she is. What's going on there? Taking children and putting them in foster care, and then they disappear. Hello.
Okay. Now, one last question. Now, you know of another person that bought 2 acres of land somewhere here in Florida. Now, what are they planning? Will that end up being a Zoom community, you think, or what?
Oh, yeah, eventually. She's from Brazil. That's the person who bought my tiny house. She's from Brazil. She has a lot of great plans, but short on labor right now to fulfill these plans. But she has a lot of great plans for her 2 acres and having, community houses where people can go and do their Wi-Fi and all that, and then around having tiny houses and then permanent buildings next to them and all that. She has great vision, and it's a process that she's slowly aware of and developing. So it's going to take a while because she's short on labor to do all that right now. So that's
it does require some labor. Now, the people with the 110 acres, they at least have 12 people.
Right. You got it.
Like the guy said, you can do a lot with 3.
Yeah, but the land I had, my tiny house, that was 11 acres of land. And that one person who owned that, he had so many challenges and struggles with just that 11 acres. and managing all the trailer homes and mobile homes and my little tiny house that was on that land. Just maintaining the trees I saw as a big, big challenge, because the trees needed trimming, the trees needed cut down sometimes, and this guy was doing most of the work himself because he didn't have enough dependable people. So, buying land, you got to plan that. Before you do it, plan it out. Who's going to help you? What needs to be done on that land? How's it going to, what timetable you going to have to make to get it done? All that should be done before you buy the land. That's the first step, is planning, to me. How many people, what are you going to do with the land? How are you going to develop it? So on and so on. Otherwise, you just got land. What does that mean if you got land and you're not doing it? Well, eventually you should do something with it, but it takes time.
Yeah, it all depends. I know of a guy in Tennessee. He's been doing, I don't know how much. He started off with, broke. And he built a tiny house for himself. He had to borrow the tools to even build it. And then after he got the first one built, somebody said, well, could you build me one? And he probably sold it for like $15,000, $20,000. Well, probably about $15,000. Anyway, long story short, now he does about $2 million a week. Oh, and he sold out his first tiny house village. And then he's got, like, I forgot, maybe 50 people living there, 54 people. And this is in Tennessee. And I think he just sold out his next one, and he's done it all, no banks involved. Absolutely no banks involved at all. So he started off with one, and then he's got a crew now of about 35. Seven people. They crank out five houses per day, and they have a crew of seven that produces one a day. So that's how he was able to go from sub-zero. He's one of these, I think one of these, he didn't have nothing planned out. He just went one day at a time. He took one step, and the universe took three, four, five steps. That's where he got to today. So, but planning does not hurt, though. It does not hurt. All right, well, you got Friday. You got your Friday topic yet?
No, it's all about, sometimes I don't get my topic till the night before because I'm watching what's going on in our earth, in our world, first of all, and I'm looking at what is the most important topic of the week, really, LA. I don't just plan a topic for entertainment's sake. I'm trying to help people change and shift to the new paradigm, new consciousness. So Friday is health and well-being. Whatever is happening during the week, I'm going to, accentuate that, highlight that, and try and bring some calm, peace, harmony, and balance to whatever happens during the week. And so far, like the monkey business, I've been talking about that a little bit, not a lot, but people need to be prepared for the fear-mongering that's getting ready to take place big time, because big pharma runs our government. If you haven't noticed that, hello. And they're gonna be up in their Camp Fear campaign for monkey business and whatever else they can create. And that's why I did a show yesterday on the truth.
Way. For the last 2 years, particularly when the pandemic started, there was a lot of, I guess, so-called fear-mongering. But that created these Zoom towns.
Well,
so is that bad or is it good?
That's
I think
therapy.
It's good.
That's the good thing about it. be aware of that. Don't get up caught up in the fear-mongering, but go create a Zoom town. That's the great part about this whole – that's the good part about the last Twilight Zone episodes we've been in 3 years, is that people realize they needed to change their lifestyle. They needed to change who they listen to on the TV, turn the damn thing off for one. That this is the good that's coming out of this. But if you're going to get caught up in the fear, you're going to be in the hospital, and that's the last place anybody needs to be. I'm telling my friend had got a bill for $80,000 for 1 hour of surgery to remove a cyst. The pharmaceutical companies are dumping drugs.
$80,000.
$80,000. And all the thing that the biggest expense was the anesthesiologist and drugs. It was three pages of drugs like fentanyl three times. I'm like reading the pages like, damn, I don't even know what these
so
are.
Hold on, who did this surgery happen to?
A friend of mine I used to live with, and she
surgery.
Ooh, a cyst. The surgery took 1 hour, and thank goodness she had good insurance. She pays $400 of the $80,000. But the bill was three pages long. I didn't see anything about the surgeon's bill. So she may be getting that later. I don't know where that is. I didn't see. All I saw was anesthesiologist, something or other, and that was like $20,000. And that might have been the doctor. But $80,000, this is what it tells us. If you go in there for surgery or anything, the pharmaceutical industry is going to dump every drug they can possibly find in you to make you feel better. They ain't about getting you well or healing your body. They want to make you feel better, and they're going to dump, and then they're going to charge the hospital at your insurance company $80,000. Hello. That's what health and well-being is all about, helping to prevent and help you keep you out in the hospital where the pharmaceutical is ready to dump drugs in your body.
Well, we're going to take a closer look at your Zoom towns because I'm sure people are doing like the guy that you interviewed, where they'll probably have some type of health program, a health clinic, in a lot of these communities.
Oh, you have to. That's part of the plan. It's how are you going to take care of the temple, the body, in this community? That has to be, and leave out the government and big pharma. That's the plan. Part of that has to be in everybody's plan when they buy land and they build in a community. How are you going to take care of your body without the government and big pharma's help?
Yeah, because they need to live near a hospital. So, Right, that's true. That's true. 314, your mic is open.
LA, you own you got insurance on your vacant lot? Huh? Hello. Oh, I tell you.
I guess we lost him. Oh, and this is Viada. How are you, Pianke?
Yeah, I was going to ask you, do you have insurance on his lot?
Why?
Why is that? Huh?
Why is that a question?
Because if you got vacant lots, or you got any land, even if there's nothing on it, you got to have insurance on it. Because if somebody come on there and hurt themselves, they can sue you. And insurance on vacant property, and I was looking at in Arizona, in Scottsdale, it can be as much as $200 or so a month. That's more than that.
Wow. Oh, boy.
You know how much acres you got. So people don't think about those things.
So would a fence, putting a fence around it be a good idea?
Huh?
Would putting a fence up around your property be a good idea to prevent the possible problems?
No. and you still got to have insurance on. It's like on your house and your regular traditional residence. Just because you got a fence on your property don't mean that you ain't liable to somebody to get on the other side. Or if something that you got in that fence gets out, like a dog or something, a bull. And them people down in Atlanta, they say they build a kingdom, but what happens when Hispanics move in there? They can't keep people from moving in. I wonder if people think about them. I say if some Hispanics wanted to, Hispanics or Mexicans or whites or anybody else wanted to move in that town, you can't keep people from moving in that town.
Well, they you can keep them off your property. He has 100 acres of private property. You keep them off your property, right?
Well, yeah, you can keep them off your property, but if you build homes on your property and have them up for sale or for rent, you can't keep other people from renting or buying them.
I don't think that's the plan. They're not building to rent. They're building to have residents living in there with food. They're going to have a lot of area where they're growing their own food, and only people who are part of their community are going to live there. They're not planning to rent anything, I don't think.
Oh, well, maybe that'll work. But you see what happened to the Amish? The FBI raided them.
Right, right. Well, I believe the brother who I interviewed has a connection with spirit, heart, the Most High, where he believes, now this is his belief, that he has a divine purpose, a divine plan, and he will have divine protection. That's how he thinks.
Well, people can have that too, but you step out in front of a truck gonna run over you. I don't care how much faith you got, whoever. That's just what's going to happen. Tornadoes come in and tear up all kinds of stuff. Look, you know what? I'm going to tell you something. You just brought something to mind. They had a tornado came through over where my daughter lived in North County outside of St. Louis. And the tornado came through the one end of Ferguson and went through the other. And you know what it seemed like it tore down? All the churches. Tore the roof off this one big church there on Airport Road, and just a little ways off of North Florida, I can't think of the name of that street. Then you go down, another church was tore up. Seemed like it hit all the churches. Although it did damage the home.
That's a powerful statement about they're getting old paradigms that don't work anymore. There you go.
So what's wrong with your phone now?
Specific reason why?
Okay, you merged onto the show right now. And
I signed off.
Pianki. Oh, you signed off?
Yeah, I signed off.
Okay, so that means we're just talking right now on the phone?
I guess so.
Well, Pianki, are you still there?
Yeah, I signed off.
Yeah, I'm still here. But anyway, LA, I sent you
I kept on. I kept on calling. I kept on saying, Viata, can you hear me? So I couldn't hear anybody on my end, so I just pressed on the M music, and that didn't play. And I just logged out. I'm not on it.
Well, it's my house is still on, and Pianki was asking you if you have insurance on your land.
And I said,
and
I did.
You got insurance on your land and these vacant lots you get?
I do.
All right. Well, I just tell Viata, when you own vacant any kind of property, you got to have insurance on it to cover your liability. And then Viata made a good point. When you buy a lot of land, especially if you live in, you got to maintain that, but cut the grass, the trees, and especially the trees, because if it ever come up a fire, that's how a lot of people homes get burnt up in California. If I was going to build a home in an area like that, I'd stay away from trees, because you have a forest fire to come over and burn your house down. then the other thing you got to consider